Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the looming government shutdown with Meredith Bagby, the author of the annual report of the USA, who earlier described the showdown as not a deficit battle but a culture war. Just today, the Senate leader Harry Reid said as much, and we look into the various riders in the Republican budget bill that are touchstones of social conservatism, not necessarily fiscal reform. Then we will try to find out whether NATO has dropped the ball or the Libyan rebels are not just up to the task. Joining us is Mansour El-Kakia, who is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He is a Libyan native and author of Libya's Gaddafi, The Politics of Contradiction. Then finally, we will examine the demonstrations that took place yesterday in Mexico against President Calderon's failed drug war that has cost 37,000 Mexican lives. Tim Johnston, the Mexico City bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers, joins us from Mexico City. Joining us now is Meredith Bagby. She is the author of the article, Government Shutdown is a Culture War, Not a Deficit Battle, now out on the Huffington Post. She is the publisher of the annual report of the USA and founder of the nonprofit organization American Education Foundation. She has penned a half a dozen books on politics and was a reporter for CNN covering economic and political issues from a youth perspective. Welcome to Background Briefing, Meredith Bagby.
Thank you, Ian.
I take it that the meeting in the White House that was postponed an hour is just beginning now at 8 p.m. East Coast time. That's between the president, Harry Reid, the Senate leader, and John Boehner, the House leader.
That's correct.
And just today, of course, the White House rejected a bill that was passed that was essentially theatrical in as much as it didn't really deal with the government funding through the rest of 2011. It was a deal that only funded the government for another week.
That's right. It funded the government for another week. It also extended military funding for the rest of the fiscal year, another 6 months. The problem with that bill that the Democrats had was the fact that it still had a lot of the riders in it that are at issue, which, as you pointed out, are largely cultural issues as opposed to purely fiscal ones.
The notion of the stopgap measures as opposed to settling a deal and finally getting this agony over with, I guess it's worth pointing out that the budget, we're talking about 2011, which should have been settled months ago.
Exactly. I mean, it should have been settled last October, in fact, when the Democrats controlled both houses. And, you know, some blame goes to them for not taking control of the budget process when they had to or when they could have. And obviously the reason for that, they didn't want to take those risky votes around election time. Of course, now they're paying the price, and we're all paying the price because we're down to the wire here with, less than 24 hours to go. At this point, though, I think it's really the Republicans that are holding up the ball. And honestly, I think what we're seeing right now is historic in the sense that normally politicians would go into this process and, you know, process and roll up their sleeves and make some decisions. We're not talking about a huge amount of money as a differential. We're talking about something that's less than 0.5% of the entire budget. But this time, things are different, and largely they're different because of the Tea Party.
But is this, though, brinksmanship where they're exercising leverage for political reasons or for budgetary reasons?
I think it has to do with social reasons. And, you know, the things that are at issue really right now we're hearing behind closed doors are things like the funding of Planned Parenthood and the funding of the EPA. These are issues which relatively take up very little of the budget, but they're hot-button issues, and they're issues that the Tea Party cares deeply about. This hot-button issue of abortion is what is most talked about. And, you know, they're really trying to push through in these final hours. They're kind of holding hostage the American government and holding hostage the budget process over these kinds of social issues. Again, relatively not a lot of money in the big scheme of things. This, to me, is totally about these social issues.
But there again, it's fraudulent, at least in my opinion, because the Hyde Amendment prevents any federal money being used on abortions. And the money that goes to Planned Parenthood, that small percentage of Planned Parenthood's activities, which have a lot to do with women's health, family planning services, breast and cervical cancer screening, and other preventative health care measures, only a small percentage of their activities involve abortions, but they are segregated out and there's no federal money going to them. So what's the point?
You know, that's absolutely right. And in fact, any abortions they do are take place in a totally separate area, and the money is totally separate. That said, I think what the Tea Party is saying, or these conservatives are saying, is we don't want any money, any federal money, going to any institution that even supports abortion. And because there's this tangential connection, they're going after Planned Parenthood. And obviously, the Democrats are right in saying, I think what the Democrats are feeling this time is they've negotiated so far and they've come up so many dollars and they've done so much, they simply can't do any more. And even in these last hours and today, the president has taken the cuts from $33 billion to $34.5, so they found another $1.5 billion cuts just today. They're unwilling to go that extra step and say, okay, take Planned Parenthood away from us, and we'll agree with you on the environmental cuts as well. So I think the Democrats are saying no more. We've done as much as we can. On the other side, typically, again, the Republicans would roll up their sleeves and say, okay, we'll give you abortion if you give us, or not abortion, we'll give you Planned Parenthood if you give us, the environmental concerns. But this time, the Tea Party is really drawing a line in the sand and saying we are going to be, this is what we were elected to do. We don't really care if we're going to be elected next time, but we've told the American people this is what we're going to do, and this is what we're going to do. And I think that is the sort of the new element in the budget debate this time around.
Again, I'm speaking with Meredith Bagby, author of the article "Government Shutdown is a Culture War, Not a Deficit Battle," now out on the Huffington Post. But still, I don't understand, Meredith, because my understanding of the Tea Party insurgency that began as a response to the outrages on Wall Street and the near-death experience of the global economy back in the fall of 2008, and that I thought they were somewhat different from the anti-abortion religious conservatives in the Republican caucus. And one part of their agenda, which has appeared since they've had representation in the House, clearly sort of supports that accusation that was out there during the campaign that these people are shilling for the Koch brothers, because the assault on the EPA to prevent the EPA from regulating the air is right out of the Koch brothers' playbook. They've got their former lawyers now in charge of the key congressional committees in this new House.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And, I think there was, at the beginning, I think the Tea Party put themselves out there. The key issue at the time they were running was the economy. And so I think they put themselves out there as, people who cared about fiscal responsibility, and that was their main issue. And these other social conservative issues, they shied away from. That said, I think down deep, and when you look at the membership of the Tea Party, and you look at Michelle Bachmann, and you look at some of the other people who support the Tea Party, they're really the same people, and they believe in social conservatism more often than not. And so I think what you're seeing is that showing itself again in this kind of vote taking. And I think that's why we are where we are right now. It's not just about, the Republicans like to say that this is just about deficit and this is just about cuts, but it's not. These are about very specific social issues, and that's what they're arguing about today. And unfortunately, that's what's sending us into a government shutdown.
Well, you mentioned Michelle Bachmann, Meredith Bagby. She's now using this deadlock to raise funds. She's putting out a missive to her followers saying, sign this petition. And by the way, in order to get to the petition, give me between $25 and $50 a head, and I'll make sure the petition gets distributed broadly.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it seems to me this hold up over abortion is identical. We saw the same thing with the health care bill. It was held up at the last care, the so-called Obamacare. It was held up at the last minute by a similar objection, and it was dealt with in very easily because it was largely fictional at any rate. So, again, what are these guys meeting behind closed doors if the problems are manufactured?
Well, I think you're right. I think, honestly, the meeting today was supposed to be at 7. It got pushed to 8. There have been people who have been talking about whether it's going to happen, how long it's going to happen. I mean, they don't have a lot. They're almost at the point where they don't have a lot to talk about. If the Tea Party is going to say no and the Democrats are going to say no, where do we go from here? And I think you get thrown into a government shutdown, at which point it's hard to understand what kind of political wins are going to take place to move somebody off their mark. And, you know, that then you get to the question of, well, who's going to be blamed for this? And I think the Republicans are feeling, look, we were the ones that got elected most recently. We promised a change. This is the change we brought, and everybody's upset. So I think that they're really in fear that they're going to be the ones to be blamed for this. And John Boehner doesn't want to be in this situation, but he too is being held hostage by the Tea Party.
So do you think, though, that this time around, I mean, I've noticed the Republicans and the Tea Party Republicans in their television appearances, they're sort of laying the groundwork for blaming the other side for a government shutdown.
Absolutely.
And saying this is not the same as it was back in the Newt Gingrich era. My understanding from what little polling there has been on this is that the American people are basically disgusted with both sides, both the Democrats and the Republicans.
I think you're right. To my mind, it will be largely laid at the hands of the Republicans. I don't know if that's true because, as you said, the polling is limited. But it seems to me that people would make the connection between the last election, wanting change, the Tea Party being such a predominant factor in what's going on, and understanding that that's where it's coming from. I could be wrong, but I think that, and I think John Boehner thinks that too. You know, he's looking, if you watch the press conferences, he's looking so very nervous about all of this. And I think that he thinks that this is going to be laid at the hands of the Tea Party and the Republican Party. So that's my guess.
Again, I'm speaking with Meredith Bagby, author of the article Government Shutdown is a Culture War, Not a Deficit Battle, now out on the Huffington Post. And just today, Senate Leader Harry Reid, one of the negotiators, said as much in frustration, it would seem. Now, let's turn to the 2012 budget and reminding the audience once again that the 2011 budget, which has now reached this kind of brinkmanship where the government may shut down because it's still not resolved, should have been resolved back in October. The 2012 blueprint that Congressman Ryan put out, again, to my mind, is so fraudulent in the sense that I thought the Tea Party movement was a populist movement, not shills for the super wealthy. And here you see in the small print one of the more revealing aspects of the budget, that the top earners in this country, the top 1% who are already doing incredibly well and have already had their tax breaks extended, along with estate taxes reduced, now they want to reduce the 35% maximum ceiling for the super rich down to 25%. It's extraordinary.
It is, and it's his way of paying for, you know, these other cuts in Medicare. And, you know, this is typically what we've been seeing from the Republican leadership in the last couple of years, which is, we're going to attack programs that actually are populist, like Medicare, and we're going to give breaks to wealthy individuals. You can't be for deficit reduction and for tax decreases for the wealthy. If we're going to be serious about reducing the deficit and going after the debt and reducing the debt, we have to do both. We have to make the cuts in entitlements, we have to make the cuts in defense, and we have to raise taxes, especially on the wealthy, who've seen great increases in their wealth over the last years at the expense, unfortunately, of the middle class. So while I applaud to a certain extent the fact that this is a bold plan that Ryan has pulled out, has created, you can't say that it is a deficit reducing plan insofar as these tax decreases for the wealthy.
Well, but surely we have to have a reality check here, Meredith Bagbo, because the federal deficit and the national debt that these fiscal conservatives or so-called fiscal conservatives decry so often and have suddenly discovered after the profligacy of George W. Bush, What is not pointed out is that the entire national debt has been doubled in the last couple of decades by Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., and George Bush Jr.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's in the entire history of the Republic. It's been half of it is responsible, has only been run up in the last few decades.
You're absolutely right. And the question goes, well, first of all, why is it that people still believe that Republicans are fiscal conservatives? I find that confusing. And two, you know, why is it that the Democrats haven't been able to get out that message that, in fact, they are the ones, at least in modern history, that have made made attempts towards balanced budgets?
Well, Clinton actually achieved it.
Exactly.
Four times.
Exactly. And, you know, and it comes down to a question of who do you trust? Who do you trust to manage the finances given the track record? And I think the Republicans don't have a great track record. And it remains to me astonishing that they are able to claim being fiscally conservative over and over again. And you have to say, as a Democrat, what are we doing wrong? Why aren't we getting that message out?
Well, but I don't understand, though, the American people and their apparently supine attitude to this continuing and growing insult to the American dream, the notion, the Horatio Alger notion of everybody can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and that we have some kind of meritocracy here in the United States. Given how the 1% have gotten so much richer in the last few decades, and now in this new 2012 Republican budget, they're going to cut their top tax bracket 10%. This seems to me to be so in your face to the American people in the context of how much the people on Wall Street have ravaged Main Street through their profligacy. Wall Street's been rewarded and made whole, and Main Street's been hung out to dry.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, if you look at what's happened since 1980, income mobility has significantly decreased. It's harder if you grew up poor to become wealthy. And it used to be we were okay with a certain amount of inequality because you realized if I grow up and I work really hard and I study really hard, I can make it. And that's becoming less and less true. The people who have money keep it, and the people who don't never get it. So the question is, why do people keep voting against their interests? Why do they keep electing people that reduce the taxes on wealthy and give all of these breaks? And that is a confusing question. I think one of the answers is that there are also social issues involved. A lot of people vote their religion. A lot of people vote their social values. And often that may align with what the Republicans are purporting rather than the Democrats. That could be one reason. Another reason is just a lack of information, a lack of understanding about the issues. And, you know, I think it's important for all of us to try to reach out to all Americans to try to explain what can be something that's relatively complex. So I think there are a lot of reasons why people vote against their issues, against their interests. And I think it's up to journalists and educators to try to explain, you know, these very difficult issues to people.
Well, isn't it also up to the Democratic leaders to make the case?
Democratic leaders. And unfortunately, you know, the Democrats tend to, what's great about the Republicans is they're very organized and they present very simple messages and they all say the same thing. And Democrats tend to be more complex and they don't repeat the same message. And I think the one thing that Democrats can learn from the Republicans is to try to be more organized, try to get behind each other, try to play as a team and try to get out very simple messages and repeat those messages very often.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Meredith Bagby. And I guess we'll just wait and see what's happening as we speak there in this meeting. But it looks like this thing could go to the mat.
It looks that way. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Again, I've been speaking with Meredith Bagby, who is the author of the article, Government Shutdown is a Culture War, Not a Deficit Battle, now out on the Huffington Post. She is the publisher of the annual report of the USA and founder of the nonprofit organization American Education Foundation. She also was a reporter for CNN covering economic and political issues from a youth perspective. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what is happening in Libya, or more to the point, what is not happening on the ground in terms of NATO defending the Libyan rebels. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now turn to the subject of the ongoing struggle in Libya. I'm now joined by Mansour El-Kikia, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's a Libyan native who has published widely on Libyan politics and society. He's the author of Libya's Gaddafi, The Politics of Contradiction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour El-Kikia.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Clearly, things are not going well in terms of the rebellion against Muammar Gaddafi and the efforts to unseat him. And I'm getting reports from intelligence sources saying that the rebels on the ground, when they call in an airstrike on a Libyan tank or some artillery, or on Gaddafi's tanks and artillery, takes about 8 hours for NATO to respond. And now we've had some collateral damage from NATO, accidentally killing some of the rebels. So could you walk us through what you think is the status quo militarily?
Well, I think it really reinforces something very important that NATO is the United States. I mean, NATO without the United States really is not NATO. The Europeans don't seem to have the necessary equipment actually to be able to do the job like the United States. This is one. They lack the organizational structure within NATO itself without the United States to actually, which is really very serious. I mean, you bring up a very, very serious issue. It shouldn't take 8 hours from one person to another person to bring a strike. And so, this, I mean, here, looking, I think it's a valuable lesson for the United States as well, too. And I think the United States looks at it and says, like children playing, you know, let's see how well you do without me, okay? But it's a serious issue, and NATO really has to reevaluate many, many things now after Libya. It has to reevaluate its tactics, it has to reevaluate its communication systems, but more important, it has to reevaluate itself. What can it do without the United States? And does not push NATO in a direction without, first of all, the approval of the U.S. I mean, France pushed really NATO into this against perhaps even Obama's own willingness to do this. And you keep in mind the fact that Obama was elected on a ticket of not going to war, of ending wars. And so he won the Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize. And so here you have an issue here for Obama, this cautiousness that hits Mr. Obama because he does not really want to be involved in this on the one hand. In spite of his morally saying, yes, Libyans should be free. But there's too much pressure on him domestically within the United States not to involve himself in Libya. And this is why when Sarkozy came up and says, we will do it, he says, go ahead, be my guest, let me see what you do. Okay. And apparently NATO is not doing a good job of it.
So Mansour El-Kikia, do you think this is a problem of NATO not having the same advanced military equipment that the United States has, or is this about their bureaucratic command structure?
I think both. I think, first of all, they don't have the necessary equipment. Even though they have modern equipment, they have American, I mean, it depends. The French have the Rafael and they have the Mirage. The British have their own
Tornadoes, yeah.
The Tornadoes, and they have a whole bunch of others, you know. And the Norwegians have the F-16s, and the Qataris have the F-18s, and you have a whole bunch of stuff in there. But apparently, the type of equipment that is needed is that things that can fly lower down. They can actually sight, see the targets, and then punch them out quickly. And most important of all, to do it quickly, fast. You know, as soon as you get the information, you're out there doing the work. It's a problem with NATO. If this is really as it is being pointed out to be, then NATO has to really, really look at its command structure very, very, very carefully.
Again, I'm speaking with Mansour El-Kikia, who is a Libyan native who's chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. So let's turn then to the rebel army itself. It's not really an army, it's a people's army. And I think people should be aware of that. I'm sure seeing pictures of people in jeans and T-shirts fighting a modern military says a lot, at least to me. But there's also this kind of Mad Max character about it, where they're all driving around in pickup trucks in a random kind of way. What would your description of this army be?
Well, you see, you're quite right. I mean, ultimately, it is a people's army. It's people who are fed up of this regime. And they got an opportunity to rise against the regime. The weapons that they have, they actually have captured from the Gaddafi's forces himself and his the security forces, and the tenacity not going back to under Gaddafi. Now there is a small army. There's a small thing about I think maybe 3,000 or 4,000 actually professional soldiers who were part of the Libyan army who actually now defected or moved away from Gaddafi. And now they're beginning to assert their influence on the situation. But still, they lack the hardware. They don't have the arms. They don't have the military capability. Mr. Gaddafi has just hired 500 experts in his latest attack against the freedom fighters, against the insurgents from Belarus. And they actually are leading his army against them.
So just to repeat that for the audience, I had not heard this information. You mean from Europe's last hardcore dictatorship,
yes,
Belarus?
Yes.
They're sending
yes.
down professional military advisors?
Yes. Yeah, no, but actually, not, they're on the field. They're actually leading those. They're actually advisors to those his commanders in his attack that actually came out of Sirte. His last two attacks, there were 500 of them, and he's paying them, I think, something like $30,000 each per operation. More important, the freedom fighters have just caught high-ranking officers of the Chadian army. And Chad, more than 3,000 Chadians moved up to help support Gaddafi because Libri in Chad is a client of Gaddafi. And so what you have ordinary citizens trying to fight a professional armies and mercenaries. And we ask Western society in the United States, you know, and others, arm them, give them some help, give them the training to do something with themselves. No, we won't do it. We will protect Benghazi. And so what you're going to find happening, they're going to come to the borders of Benghazi, you're going to find NATO coming in to bomb those, they move back, and then the whole thing starts over again. You know, the big problem over here, and this is really my biggest problem with Mr. Obama, even though I sympathize and I understand exactly where he's coming from, what the problems he's facing, and I understand the opposition, the Republican opposition, at least some Republican opposition within the United States to him. But you know something? He said something. He said, this individual must go. He cannot stay there anymore. Then what are you going to do about it? You cannot say something and then don't follow it up because you lose credibility that way. Otherwise, don't say anything. Keep quiet. It's better. This is one. Secondly, when you're in a position of leadership, you need to make a decision. It's okay to make a wrong decision. You can fix it, but you've got to make a decision. You can't stay undecided, too cautious, because that will lead to paralysis. And this is worse. Because no one will start believing in you anymore.
Well, how much though?
But they were seeing on the ground.
But Mansour, how much is Obama and NATO circumscribed by the UN mandate, which is a limited one? It's to protect
Benghazi and civilians,
not to defeat a sovereign army. And you make it pretty clear, and I think it's worth noting that there aren't too many Libyans left fighting for Gaddafi. They're mostly Chadians and Belarusian mercenaries.
I'm saying, but who's fighting against Gaddafi? That's the question. You said it yourself. I mean, people wearing jeans and T-shirts and slippers. They're civilians. So shouldn't we be protecting them?
Well, I would think, though, that there's got to be some. I mean, if this problem is one of the rebels saying, look, there's a Gaddafi tank in front of us, can you do something about it? And it takes 8 hours for them to react, and by which time the tank's probably moved on. I would think that, you know, the U.S. perfected this very, very mobile method of warfare in Afghanistan, where they put special forces teams on the ground with laser designators, and they use the air power in a very precise way. So,
but they haven't. But they haven't done that.
Well, who has? Is anybody the French?
If you don't want to do this, there are people in among the freedom fighters, among the insurgents, who can do this for them. Who can do precisely the same thing can do it for them if you don't want American boots on the ground. And I understand there's so much opposition to American boots on the ground, the opposition to British boots or French boots. But there are some. It doesn't take too long to train an individual or two or 10 or 20 people to do precisely this, to hone in on the target. But none of this is being done. Why? Because the idea, should we arm the insurgents or not? Oh, we have a problem over here. Maybe they support Al-Qaeda. But this is what Gaddafi has been spewing all along. This is his letter to Obama the day yesterday, saying, I'm fighting Al-Qaeda. You know, he has been one of the most prominent individuals to bring about Al-Qaeda in Africa, his policies. And, see, and he tries to scare the United States and the Europeans with saying, well, Libyans are going to turn all of a sudden to Al-Qaeda. What Libya wants is to get to see the end of him and have a democratic system. They have not to be afraid. Tripoli today, a city of 2 million people, is under siege. And if you've been following CNN and been following what this woman who has been raped by Gaddafi's goons, okay, she wants to leave Tripoli, but she can't because they won't let her leave. Tripoli is under siege. Misrata is encircled with tanks and fired upon, bombing, shelling day and night. And we were and the command in Benghazi was asking NATO, please hit the damn tanks. Oh, they're in populated areas. They're not in populated areas. Why don't you do something about it? And so it seems to me what happens that the commanders in Benghazi are saying, you know, what are we depending on NATO for?
Well, what about, though, given that the European left and a lot of the American left feel that this is yet another example of Uncle Sam, the ubiquitous imperialist, and there's a sense that, more than a sense, I think one of the subtexts for Obama saying to the Europeans, well, you guys deal with this, is because Europe gets its oil from Libya.
Yeah.
So that seems reasonable. But in terms of boots on the ground, I don't understand why the Egyptians don't pony up. I mean, why not get an Islamic, Arab-speaking army in there to help their brothers and sisters?
Because the regimes, unfortunately, are very close to each other. The only country that's split away from them has been Qatar. And Qatar has been doing it because just to spite the others. And we're thankful to Qatar. I mean, let me tell you something. Had Al Jazeera not shone the light on the situation in Libya, no one would know about it. And Gaddafi would have destroyed half the country. Would have. I mean, the number of people he has killed is unbelievable. The Egyptians the Egyptians never want to interfere in these issues. No, the Algerians actually supporting Gaddafi with mercenaries because they don't want. None of them want to see a democratic regime. That's the problem.
And what about Tunisia?
Tunisia doesn't even have an army.
Right.
Okay. Right. So we're falling into a situation where, unlike the situation in Iraq, has never asked the United States, come and liberate us. I mean, here is a case where you're saying Libyans are saying, hey, listen, this guy has been a dictator for 40 years. We are rising up against him. Please help us. You don't want to help us with bombing them, give us weapons so we can fight him. But now the thinking is we're taking our time to think about whether we should give them weapons or not. How long is it going to take? Will those weapons fall in the hands of terrorists? You know something? All of this is possible. All of that is quite possible. But we can never be certain about any end. I mean, the only thing we're certain about, as we always say, is death and taxes. Yes? Everything else?
Well, let me just wrap up here at the end here and get your comment. It seems to me that this could get really difficult, obviously, for the Libyan people. It could get so much worse. A divided country is untenable. A stalemate is untenable. Gaddafi seems to have resources, even, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars that he's stolen in his personal bank account. Even in spite of the 30-plus billion that the U.S. froze, he's still got money. He can buy mercenaries. He's got the Belarusians and the Chadians, etc. So he seems to have options. And unless there's some way to integrate the rebel army with the NATO air power, this thing is going nowhere. So what's your sense of what can be done? And, of course, the clock is ticking on Obama. 60 days, he's got to notify the Congress.
That 60 days, he has to notify the Congress. You're right. I mean, this is a huge dilemma for the Libyans. I mean, you're quite right. And the Libyans, this is why you find the frustration within the council in Libya. This is why you found the head of the military in Benghazi came out and spoke and said, no, you guys in it are not helping us. And this is exactly what you're saying. This is the fear. This is the major fear in Libya. But what they have to do? I mean, what? Tell me, what can those people who are freed Libya from Gaddafi do except keep on fighting? I mean, there really is this commitment to either freedom or death, and they have no choice but to do this. If they did not believe in this, you would not find that kid in blue jeans and a T-shirt with it riding a Toyota attacking a T-62 tank.
Well, Mansour El-Kakir, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mansour El-Kakir, Libyan native, who's chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas. He is the author of Libya's Gaddafi, The Politics of Contradiction. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the drug war in Mexico, where thousands demonstrated yesterday about finding a way to end this agony. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. Between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, with responsibility for China and Taiwan. He's the author of the new book, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Johnson.
Thank you very much, Ian.
There were substantial demonstrations throughout Mexico yesterday, prompted by the murder last week of the son of a very prominent poet. This 25-year-old son was killed along with five others, 24-year-old Juan Francisco Cecilia, and his father, Javier Cecilia, seems to have galvanized the nation in a protest. He actually met with the President Calderon before leading this protest and before condemning the Mexican government for basically, we're sick of you politicians. This is a badly planned, badly executed, and badly led war. You have put the country into a state of emergency. So those are fighting words.
It was, and it was his ability to articulate this frustration that led to these marches in 33 cities across Mexico. This was a pretty widespread outpouring of unhappiness with the situation, in a sense that President Calderon's strategy is not bringing results that people want.
And on top of that, of course, there was the macabre discovery of 59 bodies in mass graves in the northern state of Tamaulipas, not far from a ranch where 72 Central and South Americans were executed late last year. So there is a sort of an incredible, a level of depravity that keeps catching you by surprise in this drug war in Mexico, which has claimed 37,000 lives. Do you feel that way,
certainly,
Tim?
Certainly, you know, having a mass grave, they haven't given an official count yet of how many bodies are in there, but they say there are at least 59. Now, unlike the incident last August, some of these victims are Mexicans, and they may have been taken off public buses that were in that area. San Fernando is the name of the nearest city. And so it doesn't appear that these are all migrants, which really also is a tremendous abuse. Amnesty International came out this morning with a statement, you know, exhorting Mexicans to take this most seriously in terms of determining who did this and who the victims are.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers in Mexico City. What is the day after then? One of the things that I had heard from some specialists I'd spoken to earlier on Mexico about the drug war is that there is perhaps a cynical strategy here to essentially for the government to side with one drug lord, meaning El Chapo Guzman, let him wipe out everybody else, and then that's the only way they'll get peace. Have you heard anything to that effect?
Certainly, it's a widely held wish and belief among Mexicans who are frustrated with the violence. There was a recent poll, I believe about 2 weeks ago, that said 6 out of 10 Mexicans feel that Calderon's strategy has not worked. And in fact, the same number think he's actually losing control of the country. So that demonstrates to a certain point the level, the sort of bleak atmosphere among many Mexicans. Now, how they respond to that takes several different forms. one hears a lot of Mexicans say the strategy is not working. The government needs to negotiate with the drug trafficking organizations and basically reach some sort of accommodation. And that, you know, this is what would have happened under the institutional revolutionary party that governed Mexico for more than seven decades until the year 2000. There was really a tacit understanding with these drug organizations that, you know, one group would have control of a certain drug smuggling corridor and another group would have another one. But it really involves tremendous levels of corruption. And the real question is, you know, how you could actually organize such a thing. You know, my own personal view is sort of like how one would have gone about trying to, negotiate with Al Capone. It's a really difficult strategy, and I don't think that Mexicans have necessarily thought this out, except it just shows a real deep frustration.
Well, arguably, though, Tim Johnson, this war on drugs that has been going on for decades and has cost billions of dollars, a lot of analysts here in the United States have basically declared it dead on arrival and deeply dysfunctional. And the Mexicans' complaint largely is that you guys are the market. It's you Americans who consume these drugs, and we're bearing the brunt of your habit. You know, we've lost 37,000 of our citizens because of your drug habit. And this gets to the inevitable question of legalization is one of the words used, and medicalization may be an alternative. But a new strategy, just, you know, not continuing with Einstein's definition of insanity, keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. Mm-hmm. My understanding is every time the Mexican government has flirted with the idea of some kind of legalization, the United States has come down on them.
Well, the legalization trend in the public opinion is certainly moving in the direction of saying this is something that needs to be studied. You know, every month or two, one has new intellectuals and public sort of pundits come out in favor of this, including the former president Vicente Fox, is one of the most prominent advocates of a legalization strategy. It's very difficult in this political environment, though, to make headway on something like that without doing it in coordination with other countries, unless one is determined to sabotage a relationship with the U.S. That's because Washington is so dead set against it. It's a really a difficult thing. But in the marches yesterday, legalization was one of the subjects that one could read on the banners of people doing the marching. So, you know, a lot of people believe that that is, you know, definitely something that Mexicans should consider.
But in terms of the banners of the thousands of people who marched in protest, galvanized by this popular poet and journalist whose son was murdered in Cuernavaca, which is a very safe place where young Mexicans go to get married and have honeymoons, etc. I'm interested to get a sense of the cross-section of those who demonstrated, because it seems to me that if you've got this frustration with the public, sick of this, feel that the government's not pursuing the right strategy in this war and they just want it over with, doesn't that open up an opportunity for the cartels, who have enormous resources at any rate, to basically wear the authorities down and just say, you know, the only way out of this is a truce?
Well, I would say several things. First, on the composition of those who come out, it's very varied. You had older people here in Mexico City. You had lots of young people. The banners, the most consistent banner was the slogan that's been in use for a couple of months now, which it basically in Spanish would be "No más sangre," no more blood. So that kind of captures the mood that people are just tired of just a horrendous string of atrocities that are occurring, either by violence between the drug trafficking organizations or by the state battling the cartels or the cartels battling back. I must say, though, that I just arrived yesterday from a trip to Central America where I was also reporting on what I consider to be a really an untold story of very weak governments succumbing to drug trafficking organizations down there, which we could touch on in a minute if you wanted, but I was expecting actually more people to turn out at these marches than did. The estimate is that there were about 20,000 here in Mexico City. But given the levels of violence and given the articulateness of this poet, Javier Cecilia, I thought that actually more people would turn out. And it puzzles me a bit why there isn't a larger mass movement in Mexico to say enough.
Well, that could translate, though, Tim Johnson, again, Mexico City Bureau Chief for the McClatchy newspapers. We're talking to Tim in Mexico City. Isn't it possible that the PRI party could come back and capitalize on this? You know, when the PRI were in, they made a kind of cozy deal with the drug cartels, and there wasn't any violence, but there was deep corruption. Calderon has tried to clean up Dodge, and it's not working. And the cartels are basically turning up the heat, and the blood is flowing because they're that ruthless.
Yeah. Well, here's what I would suggest about the PRI strategy. You know, we have presidential elections next year, but the PRI is not focusing on the violence and the drug counter-drug strategy as its linchpin for this campaign. They're focusing on the economy, and so that gives you an idea that, you know, while it's horrendous, and as we read about it as foreigners, it seems that the levels of violence have really become just, almost incomprehensibly high. A lot of Mexicans are far more concerned about joblessness and, an economy that has failed to sort of pick up and create better opportunities for people. That is a predominant concern, despite this terrible drug violence situation.
And, of course, the recession here in the United States has dried up that safety valve that Mexico's always had of exporting its unemployed to the United States. And, of course, the United States has made it much more difficult to make these crossings, witness where you've got also people coming up from Central and South America as well, who are preyed upon in Mexico. So the whole thing is really quite tragic. But let's turn to Central America, where you just returned from, Tim Johnson, because a while back I spoke with the former vice president of Costa Rica, who said, and it surprised me what he said, but he said, you know, the government of Guatemala is a narco government. Guatemala is lost to the cartels. Honduras is under threat, and so is El Salvador, where the president recently visited. My understanding is that what's happened here is that Plan Colombia in Colombia drove the cartels out of Colombia into Mexico, and Plan Merida in Mexico is now driving them into more hospitable places in Central America.
That's absolutely correct. It's squeezing the balloon at both ends, and so the trafficking organizations have moved heavily into the northern part of Guatemala, what's known as the Petén. I was there last October, and I can tell you that there are parts of it that are virtually a no man's land. There's areas in one national park that are virtually a boneyard for discarded airplanes by the drug traffickers. I was just in Honduras, and for the first time ever, they have discovered a cocaine processing laboratory in Honduras. It's never been found outside of the Andean region. So the drug cartels are actually bringing up semi-processed coca paste into Honduras to process into actual refined cocaine in Honduras. It has never happened. So, you know, it's another sign that the drug organizations are really finding a better venue for their activities in places like Honduras. You know, there are parts of Honduras also where they're getting five or six tracings of aircraft coming in from Colombia and Venezuela of unidentified aircraft every day. And these are, you know, routinely drug flights. So I spoke with a security minister in Honduras, and he told me that that there are 10 members of Congress that have open investigations for links to drug organizations. So, another man told me he thought the number more accurately would be 16. So more than a 10% of the Congress is believed to have direct links to the drug industry. It's a pretty dramatic situation.
And Tim Johnson, in terms of Guatemala having been taken over by criminals and Honduras being in the process of being taken over by criminals, my understanding is also that Venezuela, led by Hugo Chavez, who has regional ambitions and a strong political agenda, that he's nevertheless presiding over a totally dysfunctional country with one of the highest crime rates in the world. And basically, the drug traffickers have a free rein there.
Well, I think that the drug traffickers have been able to strike up alliances with sectors of the Venezuelan military. And so, I don't think Chavez has necessarily been complicit, but the military has been able to foster some of these networks. And so a lot of the drug the planes that come out of Colombia instead fly west into Venezuela, then they fly north either, you know, towards the Caribbean or towards Honduras and Mexico. And that's because the Colombians have been very effective at closing down what they call the air bridge. They've just, you know, shut down the skies with the help of the U.S., of course. And that's, you know, that's what's caused a number of the changes in drug smuggling practices. You know, a lot of the Colombians organizations are now using these submarines. First, there was semi-submersible vessels that would bring loads of cocaine up, but now they have full-fledged 100-foot submarines that can dive as low as, you know, sort of 24, 25 feet underwater, and the Colombians don't have the sonar equipment to really detect these vessels. So
sure, they make them out of fiberglass too, so that
they make them out of fiberglass, right. And they can carry, you know, a number of tons, 8-10 tons of cocaine, and they can go all the way up as far as San Diego with these things. And turn around and go back. And so it's, this has made a very large new challenge for interdiction.
Well, Tim Johnson, I'm afraid we've run out of time here in Los Angeles. I thank you so much for joining us from Mexico City, where Tim Johnson, of course, is the bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He's also the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Just in closing, though, the Dalai Lama, of course, now basically has quit, right?
Well, he's done a very interesting tactical maneuver. He's declared that he will end his political role as a leader of the Tibetans and really only be a spiritual leader. And I say it's tactical because the Dalai Lama, of course, has always been pressing Tibetans to empower themselves to make decisions, whereas the Tibetans have been very reluctant they've always wanted the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, to make the decisions for them. And so, you know, as he's in the twilight of his life, he is trying to help usher in an era in which they will do more of their own decision-making. They will embrace democracy, have a political leader that they've elected, which they've done, by the way. They've elected a new prime minister. And so I think it's really a symbolic move. He, of course, continues worldwide travels. So he'll be in the U.S. In just a matter of a few weeks again. So he's the most visible figurehead of the Tibetan movement, and that won't change.
Well, Tim Johnson, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Mexico City here on Background Briefing.
You're very welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Tim Johnson, Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Well, let's do it. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com along with my new blog at ianmasters.com. Bye for now.